Welcome to Fireside Markets, your audio home for thoughtful and insightful discussions of financial markets, investment strategies, economics, retirement, and more. Fireside Markets is hosted by James Osborne, president of Basin Asset Management, a Colorado registered investment advisor.
Good morning, this is James Osborne, and you're listening to Fireside Markets, a project of Basin Asset Management. Today's topic is the business of asset management and portfolio management. And I'm very pleased to have with me Josh Brown. Josh is CEO of Ritholtz Wealth Management, a frequent contributor to CNBC. Probably Josh is best known as the man behind the Reform Broker blog. He is also the funniest guy on finance Twitter and the author of Backstage Wall Street and Clash of the Financial Pundits. Josh, welcome to Fireside Markets.
What a buildup. Now I'm intimidated.
Well, you'll just have to prove that. You'll just have to prove that you are worth it.
Okay. Fine.
So, hi. Thanks for joining me this morning, Josh. The topic I'd like to discuss with you is the business of portfolio management and the current landscape and changes that we've seen. Spend a few minutes. Give me your thoughts on the biggest changes we've seen in asset management over the last 3 to 5 years and what you think is coming over the next 3 to 5 years.
I think probably the biggest change that we've seen in the last 3 to 5 years is an acceptance, a mass acceptance of passive strategies. I think part of that is born as a result of just a disappointment with active management during the crisis, but a concurrent realization that you have to invest. So I think people have split the difference. They've said, well, I don't trust anyone. And the guy that generates the most alpha is going to give it all up in the crisis anyway. So if I have to be in, what's the easiest way I can be in without having to trust a person? And what they've decided on is, well, let's do it through ETFs. Let's do it through indexing. Let's do it through Vanguard. So all you have to do is look at Lipper or ICI data, and it's pretty clear that people have resigned themselves to the fact that they have no choice but to invest, but they're not excited about investing and they're not chasing the hot dot the way they did in the 80s and 90s. It's just not meaningful to people anymore. Who manages their money? I think ease of use is now the new thing, and just being in is good enough.
Does passive have staying power?
Passive is staying power until the next period of a flat market or the next prolonged downturn in the market. And then some of the Johnny come latelys will be shaken from the tree and they'll be attracted to whoever is perceived as someone who called the next crisis or someone who's demonstrating an ability to make money while markets are flat. And you'll see a mass exodus to whatever that manager or strategy is. I don't know who it'll be, but that's the way we tend to behave, and it's totally understandable. George Orwell has a great quote where he says, whoever is winning now will appear to be invincible. So a passive allocation to the S&P 500 is winning, and it's winning by a landslide. So that's what people want. When that stops winning, someone else will be perceived as, oh, this is the next hot guy or a strategy or type of investing. And then you'll see everyone run into whatever that is. And, that'll go on year after year until we're dead.
To your earlier point about flows, we've seen tremendous money go to low-cost ETFs, Vanguard, etc. It's also been a remarkably easy, I use that term carefully, but a remarkably easy time to be passive, to own the S&P 500. Thankfully, well, or not, it's beat every other asset class you could imagine or throw into a portfolio. And I'm hard-pressed to believe, generally speaking, that we've permanently altered our behavior as investors, that we're suddenly able to take long-term focus and recognize that, performance chasing is never good for us. I'm inclined to agree with you that we'll see what happens next. So what happens next in asset management?
I think liquid alternatives are going to boom. And I think the primary reason for that is financial intermediaries, particularly investment advisors at wirehouse firms, who I think they themselves are tired of stock pickers and having actively managed funds that underperform. But I think what's really important to them is to demonstrate their value to the client. And their value to the client has always been in manager selection, or I'm managing the managers. And so they're going to gravitate now toward this idea where, well, I'm going to pick the best non-correlated strategies for you. And so I think that that's an area that you're going to see brokers and advisors with brokerage licenses selling in a major way. It's going to be a big part of their value proposition, and they're going to love using these funds. And it's happening already, but it's so small. It's got so much room to grow. So I think that you're going to hear more and more about that kind of thing going forward.
Yeah, it's really tough to be in a position where, as a professional, you hold yourself out as being the provider of solutions, especially when those solutions are products, and then have this massive tidal wave come against you of a mountain of evidence that shows that those solutions have have completely failed. And so they've got to turn around and find something new so that they can continue to be the provider of solutions to defend their value proposition as an, quote unquote, investment specialist. Are any of the liquid alts worth it?
Well, the first true test we've had, now that it's an actual segment of the marketplace, was from September 19th to October 15th, a period during which the S&P 500 dropped by 10% really quickly, and it caught a lot of people off guard. Morningstar looked at the 81 largest liquid alternative funds, and they found that 70 of them went down. So of the 11 that went up, the gains themselves were fairly mild, so they were non-correlated, but you still lost money overall in the category. And I guess that's fine. You probably lost less on average. I forget exactly what the data said, but I don't think you lost 10% on average. But I think the point is that's the first test that we've had of these things. And I'm not sure that you can say that that's a victory per se, losing less money in a 1 month 10% correction, given how much you trail the market by in the month since. And obviously you've trailed substantially. So, do you want to lose less and make less? Yeah, that's probably a good approach. But you can do that already,
right,
with a 60-40 portfolio and not pay 1.85% in an internal cost. I mean, you already have ways of losing less, making less. So, this idea that non-correlation is like really hard to accomplish, again, the evidence suggests that that's not the case. Long-term treasuries are pretty darn non-correlated to stocks in a market panic. So, you can pull this off, is the point, without having a volatility arb fund or a long short fund or whatever, whatever the thing is that they want to talk about.
Risk parity.
Yeah. It's not to disdain these strategies. Everything has its moment, right? Every form of investing has its time where it's in favor and where it's out of favor. So the question really becomes, if you're going to commit to one of these things, how long are you willing to commit to it for, and how will you judge its efficacy in the context of an overall portfolio? And I really don't think that anyone's answering that question or even asking it of themselves. So I think it's a product in its infancy. I think there'll be winners and losers like anything else, but I think anyone looking for something that's always going to work, just like in every other facet of this industry, will end up being disappointed, because nothing always works and nothing is all season.
Don't tell Tony Robbins that.
I mean, come on, all season.
I'm gonna move on.
I had a tweet last year when the risk parity funds blew up, and I said, "Man creates all season portfolio. God laughs."
Right.
It's a great idea. And again, I know it's worked through several periods of time in the past really well, and that's great. Nobody says that it won't. But always, sorry.
Yeah, it seems from where I'm sitting that a lot of the liquid alternatives end up just being really expensive beta. You know, we get a fund that captures 40% of the upside and 40% of the downside. Well, like you said, that's pretty easy to accomplish in a much simpler structure, although that simple structure,
you know,
is harder
to sell. I can do that in a 401k account.
Right.
I could seriously do that with a teller who sits in a cubicle in the lobby of my bank. Yeah. I can pull that off, you know. So, look, it's not that there's anything wrong with being creative and innovating and trying to bring sophisticated strategies to the masses in an easier package. I'm cool with that. I just think that, you know, people need to have reasonable expectations.
Yeah, and that's really, really hard to pull off. To take a complex, you know, let's say high-level successful hedge fund strategy, of which I'm willing to say there might be a handful, and dilute that down to the retail level and package it in a mutual fund, and after taxes and cost, deliver some premium of a return there. I think for the most part, the industry is really discounting how difficult that is to execute.
Yeah, but so if you're marketing these things, though, you can always find a time frame where they did deliver that, and then that's the time frame you market.
Right.
So maybe it's the beginning of 07 through the beginning of 2012, and you take that five-year span and you show the strategy versus the S&P, and of course, it looks pretty good. And then you say, well, this is not always going to work, but here's where it works really well. And I think that's a fair approach, but just understand you're cherry picking a time frame during which a very specific thing happened. But here's the interesting thing. Somebody that's very high up at Goldman who is involved with vetting hedge funds for their asset management side, took a meeting with a very central liquid alts company that's on the forefront of creating and marketing these strategies. And they talked about how to get ultra high net worth investors interested in liquid alts. And the comment from the Goldman guy was, sir, you don't understand. Everything you're saying makes perfect sense. And you're delivering a similar strategy for a tenth of the cost. But that's not what our clients want. They want to be in the fund. They want access to the funds, to the fund manager and the fund manager's thoughts. They want to be invited to the golf outings, and they want the exclusivity of knowing that the people who work for them at their company can't also access the same fund. So what you're doing actually is shooting the whole hedge fund sales pitch in the foot by making this affordable and democratizing it. What makes you think that these people have any interest in a democratized anything? And I thought that was really interesting. And if you look at that mentality as it manifests itself in other areas of life, you know, there is a market for Tiffany, and not everybody wants Zales. There is a market for Godiva, and not everyone wants Hershey. Now you can make the argument that, well, Tiffany is obviously higher quality than Zales, but can you truly say that Godiva is better than Hershey? So I think the marketing of these things as a high end luxury status symbol type product maybe has a lot to do with why there's $3 trillion in an asset class, if you could call it that, that consistently underperforms almost everything.
Yeah. Well, and it's the easiest sale to make as a broker to say, dear Mr. and Mrs. Client, now that you have money, let me show you what we keep in the back room. You know, that the masses, the dirty, unwashed masses are not welcome to see what we keep back here.
Yeah,
but you are.
You deserve this.
Right. Congratulations, you've arrived.
You've earned the right to be invited into this world. And you know, people don't look, people don't, we're on the web and we're on social media and we obsess about this stuff all day long, right? We're having these debates that are like super wonky, and every one of us, our colleagues, James, we all know what the benchmarks have done and what volatility is and blah, blah, blah. Most people, they don't have, you know, they're not watching that closely. They don't really care. But they do love to go out golfing with their friends and say, oh, I'm with David Einhorn. Well, how have David Einhorn's returns been for the last 5 years? I don't know. I don't care.
Why would I care?
And I get it. Makes sense. You know, it's people's priorities. What, you tell somebody that they don't want something that they want?
Right. Somebody's going to sell it to them. So might as well be you. I mean, that.
I guess.
That mentality, it's going to be hard to get rid of, I think.
Won't be me, but.
Yeah, right. And when I say might as well be you, I don't mean you, and I don't mean me, obviously.
Right.
You know,
customer is always right.
Right. You know, on the. To touch on the liquid alts piece one last bit, I think the best example we have of this in terms of success or failure is managed futures. And managed futures has been this phenomenal experiment in performance chasing, behavioral finance, the non-correlated asset class. You know, managed futures looked amazing during the bear market. And so everybody chased it. And then just absolutely fell flat. And I imagine that we'll see flows come out right before we get another bear market and another huge trend, maybe a big upswing in currency or commodity or something that's going to play to their favor. And everybody will miss it again.
So commodities in general or managed futures specifically?
Pick one.
I think you make the argument for either.
I agree.
You have to be very careful discussing this topic because the managed futures mafia is super defensive. And if you even use the term without even disparaging it, they will come out and do a 1,000-word post on their site about why they're misunderstood and why you're using the nomenclature wrong and blah, blah, blah. I tend not to wade that deep into the fray on managed futures. I personally don't really understand it, so I don't critique it. All I really know is that I don't need it. So that's kind of kept me out of that discussion.
Yeah, I have a memory of sitting with in the offices of a big fund of funds managed futures fund here in Denver and feeling exactly what you just expressed, which was, I don't understand where returns come from in this quote unquote asset class. And they had a really hard time answering that fairly straightforward question. And, you know, not to sit and pick on managed futures, but I think what you see is everybody wants this non-correlated, ideally big positive numbers in a bear market strategy. But most investors aren't willing to take the associated cost of that, which is in all likelihood dramatic underperformance in a bull market.
So the only statistic that I think most investors, there are two of them. These, to me, when somebody says, should I be in this? Do I need to own silver? Do I need managed futures? Do I need private equity? Do I need non-correlation? How much non-correlation do I need? To me, the only two statistics that you really need to know are these. The first is, if you pick any day over the last 50 years, half century, which is pretty much as long as anyone we know will have to invest, even if they start in their 20s. You pick any day over the last 50 years, you have a 74% chance that the stock market, the broad U.S. stock market, is higher 1 year later. That's any day of any month of the last 50 years. So right off the bat, you know which way the odds are leaning. The second statistic is there are zero rolling 20-year periods beginning in any month of any year going back to 1926 during which the S&P 500 had a negative return or the stock market. We'll use the Dow before. But if you know that over 20 years stocks win, or at least have historically every single time. And if you know that you have a 75% chance of being in the black on an investment in equities a year later, again, historically, how non-correlated do you want to be? Right? And how much effort and how much money do you want to put toward that grail quest to find the thing that's going to make you a fortune to bear market? Just knowing those two statistics. And I think when you lay that out for people, they say, okay, well, I like the idea of having a hedge, but maybe I don't want to bet against that in a major way or spend a fortune trying to do it. So I find that that kind of conversation centers people a little bit. Reasonable people, you know, not people that they live and die, you know, on alpha, but reasonable people who are just investing to get through their lives and enjoy it. I find that that kind of thing centers the conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I've had conversations with people where they want to own, you know, a bear fund, or they want to own the VIX, so they're guaranteed to own something, well, quote unquote guaranteed to own something that's going to go up when the market goes down. And the question is, why do you want to be negatively correlated to an asset class that goes up over time? I mean, there's just no answer to that. But
yeah, we're not maniacal permabulls. And we're not of the school that says it's better when the market goes up. We actually, you know, we think about economic cycles and market cycles, and we talk a lot about in our private communications with our client base. We talk about the benefit of recessions, the benefit of bear markets, why they're necessary, what they do for a portfolio, what they do for the economy, how many great businesses have been able to have been started because prices have come down and real estate space became available in a recession. So, you know, we're not like these maniacal people who are just go, 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 buy, buy, buy. But we know that the statistics say you're better off being in than not. And bigger picture, man, I'm 37 years old. I'm going to live to see Dow 100,000 if I start eating right at some point. And so, you know, and I understand, you know, someone who's 70 doesn't have the same luxury, but just generally speaking, our worldview is that bad things happen, but they tend to work themselves out. And if they don't, right, if something bad happens and the markets don't recover, well, you'll be in the same boat as everyone else, and you'll have bigger problems on your hands than how correlated you were.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the alternative to, you know, a capitalist market-based system continuing to work is a pretty scary scenario. And, you know, your investments there, gold isn't the solution there. Probably canned tuna and bottled water is a better solution.
So tell me what your paper shares of gold are going to do for you when your counterparties are out of business and the vault is raided by an angry mob of cannibals where the gold is held. Like, what are your shares of GLD really going to hedge you against, right?
Well, and who's to say that we're going to use gold as any form of investment or currency when that does happen? No, you know, who's to say that a water filter isn't more valuable than gold at that point?
Right. I think in that kind of a scenario, probably suicide makes the most sense, and then maybe palladium.
You brought up an interesting point, which is the value that you perceive to bring to clients. And I'd like to talk about that a little bit. If we live in a world where alpha is very elusive and the traditional model of a wealth manager, financial advisor, broker, whatever you want to call us, was to, you know, bring products and solutions and managers to the client. If that world is crumbling, what do we do? What's your role? What do you do all day? What's your value proposition to clients, and how is that different than what it would have been 20 years ago?
So I think I'm three things to my clients. First is I'm a bouncer. I keep the riffraff away from them and out of their portfolio. And I can't put a dollar value on that. All I know is if I can keep somebody from making a decision that costs them huge money, whatever fee I'm taking is irrelevant, you know, relative to what I can save them from. And every time I get a portfolio sent to me that's loaded up with Pacific Rim gold mining stocks or somebody that's having an annuity jammed at them by a college roommate or whatever, I know that I'm earning my keep. The second thing I am is a teacher. I try to make myself smarter every day, which is why I do the blog and why I work so hard on my own education so that I can pass on the important stuff to the people that I work for. And they're not going to do that because either they're retired and enjoying the fruits of their labor, or they're hard at work all day focusing on what makes them successful. So it's my job to kind of be the chief intelligence officer, so to speak, and to communicate to them what I think is important about what's happening now and the central precepts of investing that are going to enable them to continue their lifestyle for decades to come. The third thing I am is a coach, and you know, or somebody might call it a psychologist, whatever you want to call it. And I'm not trained in psychology by any means, but I've learned over 15 years in this business what's effective in terms of helping people and what's not, and how to walk people through these moments when they're either getting really greedy or really fearful and keeping them from making the big mistake. And so if I can be the bouncer, the teacher, and the coach, and I can do that in a cost-effective way for the client, the service that I'm providing is invaluable. We can talk about active versus passive till the cows come home. That shit doesn't matter. In the end, how much alpha you generated or didn't generate, or did you use iShares or State Street? None of these things are important. The important thing is keeping people on a path toward hitting their goals. And I think by playing those three roles, I'm able to do that.
Yeah, the low-hanging fruit of investor success is certainly not, are we going to pick up 10 basis points by, you know, moving to the iShares core ETF?
No.
But, you know, can we save 300 to 400 basis points a year in taxes, behavioral costs, you know, avoiding terrible product structures? But we get caught up in the minutiae sometimes. I think a part of that is we, and when I say we, I mean the financial blogosphere, finance Twitter, the little community that we live in, we've created sort of a homogenous environment where we don't disagree about enough things, big things. So we find little things because we find it really interesting. And I'm for that. I think sometimes we lose sight of how bad it can be out there for people. You know, I'll get in a conversation with somebody like Colin Roche or with you about, you know, active passive or, you know, global allocation or something like that. And then you get a new client statement that comes across your desk that literally is tactical fund of funds of ETFs with a 2.5% advisory fee wrapped around it. And you just have to look at it and think, This is what we're trying to protect people from. The little things that we discuss sure are fun, but it's easy for us, I think, to forget how bad it can be out there for people.
That's right. And, you know, again, I talked about these kind of wonky discussions that we're having on the fringe of the financial web, and I enjoy them every bit as much as you probably do. And by the way, one of the best parts about being involved on the financial web is all the contacts I've made. And to a man or a woman, every single person I'm reading has, I think, made me smarter and helped me get better at my job and helped me be a better advisor to my clients. So it's not that I disparage these arguments that we have or the minutia that we get bogged down in. I treasure it, but I think you're right, because the bigger picture that most people care about is not about the efficacy of Morningstar ratings or the tax alpha that can be captured in a harvesting strategy. You know, that's all like very, very fringe, and what the typical investor really needs from us is something much more general, which I think is a logical framework with which to build a portfolio and then maintain it. But we need to be having those discussions, even if they're really like a corner of the industry and not terribly important, because I think they shape our understanding and I think they contribute to our overall knowledge. So I'm really glad that we can be both things. We can be investment nerds and obsess over minor topics, and at the same time, we can create these really broad, kind of easy to understand investment theses that actually help people.
In being investment nerds and getting caught up in discussions of macroeconomic data and Fed minutes and Shiller PEs and margin growth or compression and all the things that we enjoy talking about, how much of that is interesting information and how much of that is actionable information?
I mean, it depends on what you... So the thing with me is that a good percentage of my readers and the people I interact with are in the industry, and that stuff's really important to them because they're traders or they're fund managers or they're macro strategists or whatever they do for a living. And that's the mother's milk. That's what they do. Their job is to interpret these things, even if they're just making it up as they go along, which, as you and I know, they frequently are, still important to them. So it's, you know, for me, I think I have three different types of readers. I think I have professionals at all different levels of the investment industry, including my own colleagues. And then I think I have regular investors who have wandered onto my site because of a link somewhere, because they saw me on TV or whatever. And then the third category are like people that sell to the industry, vendors of products or other types of website media people or whatever the case may be. So I think communicating to an audience that's like a three-headed kind of entity is probably my biggest challenge, but it's the thing that I think is what has made my site relevant to a large amount of people, is that I've somehow figured out a way to do that. You know, if you're just out there calling BS on everything and saying nothing matters, okay, that's an interesting point of view for about 15 minutes, but then why would anyone read anything else that anyone has to say? So I think some things do matter, some things don't. Some things matter a great deal to some people, and to others they shouldn't matter at all. And then finding a way to be able to talk about everything is probably the secret to why my blog has attained the readership that it has, and hopefully I can keep that going.
Yeah, you sit in an interesting intersection, and one that I don't necessarily envy. You know, my background is not in the trading space or anything like that, where you have that exposure from Barry and your readers. But it gives you a perspective that's different than, you know, sort of a retail advisor's, and there's value there, if only because it's interesting information.
I'll tell you what's really cool, and what I am, you know, it's a couple of days before Thanksgiving. We're recording this for the day before. What I'm really thankful for is that, and this was not premeditated, but I sit in the midst of a core of people who I work with, and they all come about this business from a different angle. And I think to some extent, they've triangulated around me, and I can pull in the most important aspects of what all of them focus on and talk about. So my partner is Barry Ritholtz, and his big thing is the macro economy and historical cycles. And it's not that he's like making predictions, but it's just, that's what fascinates him. That's what he reads about. That's what he writes about. That's what he spent his entire career seeking to have a better understanding of. And I've learned a ton about that stuff working with him for the last 4.5 years. My director of research is a guy named Michael Batnick. He's a hardcore markets guy with a deep obsession in terms of portfolio construction. So I get a lot of interesting, you know, intel and feedback from him. We have great conversations about the right way to invest, what's happening in the market now, does it matter? And these are really high-level discussions that I've never had the ability to have so frequently with a coworker until he joined me a couple of years ago. And then the other guy that's worth mentioning is Chris Venn, who's my firm's director of financial planning. And he's a CFP. He doesn't really care much about the day-to-day movement in the market at all. He's not focused on what stocks are at all-time highs or what strategy is outperforming. He is doing hardcore client service day in, day out, and he's doing planning work. And his perspective is entirely based on how to help people reach their goals, how to get people through retirement with a sufficient amount of income, and how to adapt to the changes in people's personal situations. So, you know, I get to come to work and get feedback on all three of those concepts on an ongoing basis and interact with all of those facets of what we do. And it's amazing. And I wouldn't trade it for anything. And I commute, my commute is over 3 hours a day total, just so I can do that and come into the city and interact with my colleagues each day. But it's invaluable. And I feel as though I get smarter, if not every day, at least every week as a result of it.
Yeah, and certainly something all of us should hope for at a minimum. Before I let you go, maybe here in the last 5 or 10 minutes, you're a young guy. I'm even younger than you. What do you see for us 20 years from now? What does this look like? Does the influence of the so-called robo-advisors change the nature of the industry? Is what people want going to change over the next 20 years? What's your day going to look like 20 years from now? What's my day going to look like 20 years from now?
I got a really good piece of advice recently from someone close to me who works at Facebook. And he's involved on a team there that's going to bring in, you know, $100 million in revenue, and there are three of them, you know, generating that business. And, you know, his basic premise about, and you know, he's a little bit older than me, a little bit wiser, but he's not involved with Wall Street. But his basic premise is you have to be thinking about being in a business that makes money while you sleep. And, you know, people approach him, hey, invest in my restaurant. You have a ton of money. You know, and he looks at that, he says, are you kidding me? A restaurant? That is the most labor-intensive, annoying business I could possibly be involved with.
It has one of the highest failure rates you could dream of.
But just think about you're selling a dish, even a high-end restaurant, it's a $30 entree, but it's $15 worth of labor and parts that go into that 30, and how much time it takes to turn that out. Who wants to do that? He said, I'd rather invest in a vending machine and have it connected to the web and have it automatically refilled and have nothing to do with it and just collect the money. Now, that's a luxury that not everyone has, but I think if you can think that way and not fear the robots, but find a way to put them to work for you and put them to work for your customers, you know, so look, we're hiring bodies, people, right? We're not totally convinced that robots can do everything. I don't think artificial intelligence can ever truly replace wisdom, expertise, experience, even learning AI type of machines. But you know, I think this idea of investing in technology as opposed to building a factory that's you know got to be staffed all day and you've got to put your back into it. You know, I think that's the way people's minds should be oriented. And in a finance context, I think that means automating what you can so that you can use the time you're saving for the things that you can't, which I would consider to be advice, conversations with people, hand-holding, et cetera. There are things that we do, James, that artificial intelligence will not be able to do. And the best way to think about that, the best analogy, is to think about how incredible Pixar movies, or now Disney movies, these computer-generated animation, how far that stuff has come. And yet you look into the character's eyes and the eyes are dead. And they can't find a way to inject that last mile of humanity into, or sentience, into these incredible renderings that they've been able to do of animals, of people, and I don't think they ever will be. And by the same token, I do not think that anyone will ever be able to truly deliver advice without actually delivering the advice in a human way, at least not advice that counts. So we're trying to use technology. We're trying to build our practice around this idea that many things can be automated, but not the most important things. So I think being a technology-assisted advisor, you ask me, what does 10 years from now look like? 10 years from now, I hope to be spending my time helping people, not spending my time trying to manipulate things on a spreadsheet or pressing enter on a keyboard. And so hopefully we can all find a path towards something like that.
I can't agree more. The idea that the robo-advisors, quote-unquote, present a threat to good advisors is almost laughable to me, not because they can't deliver a good product, because they absolutely can, but product isn't ultimately what people come to an advisor for. Not if they have a good advisor.
Yeah, I think it's reasonable to say that there's going to be a convergence and that we won't be using the term robo-advisor in a couple of years, because yes, everyone that survives and is still in this business will be a technology-assisted advisor.
Right.
And we'll be using technology to varying degrees, some of us more than others, but we'll be it'll be cybernetic, you know, it'll be people with the assistance of the best of robotech. Look, the technology will be commoditized very soon.
Yes.
So I happen to have my own product called Liftoff. I think we're the first RIA to roll out what people are calling a robo. But the reality is we actually developed the portfolios and we're people and we built the matrix behind them. And you know, we shaped the customer experience, even though it's not on the telephone or in a conference room, it's online. You know, we kind of worked with the technology provider and we came up with what we think is a good solution for a certain type of client. But, you know, the clients that are going into that product, they will get older, they will have financial situations that become more complex, and they will have more desire for human contact. And when that happens, they'll graduate into our wealth management practice. And you know, that convergence, I think, will play out across the country. We won't be as unique in 2 years as we are today.
Most likely not. But you'll have a first mover advantage, which is great for you guys. And like you said, I like your term, the technology-assisted advisor. It seems inevitable that will come to fruition and ultimately free up advisors to do what they're actually good at, because no one gets into this business, like you said, to move cells around on an Excel spreadsheet or, you know, place trades at their custodian. You do this because people need advice and they want to talk to you.
Look, right. So there are things that can be automated and where they can be, they should be. And there are things that can't. Rick Edelman, who's a veteran of our industry and someone who's had a lot of success, he's a big believer in the technology-assisted advisor future. He's a big believer in the singularity, which we won't get too far down the road on that discussion. But
not today.
He tells a great story about he went to Japan and he was given a tour of an auto manufacturing plant. And the lights are off. The first thing he notices is they're building cars in this plant, but the lights are off. He says, "Why are the lights off?" They said, "Well, machines don't need lights. Humans need lights." And then the second thing he notices is there's only one human being on the factory floor, and there's a dog. And he says, "Well, what are they for?" So they said, "Well, the man is there to feed the dog." He said, "Well, what's the dog there for?" "Well, the dog is there to make sure the man doesn't touch anything." So you think about, we've figured out a way to completely automate the manufacture of cars in a factory setting like that. But somebody has to come up with, how do we sell the car? How do we market it? Somebody has to design the car. Somebody has to say, this is going to make for a better vehicle than that. These features, this equipment, these accoutrements of the cabin, whether it's a certain color of leather or whatever. So, you know, that's where industry is going. The things that can be done by a machine are going to be done by a machine in most cases. But then the things that are more qualitative, the things that are more human, are going to require humans. So I think you want to own the robots. You want to you want to have capital and investment in the technology itself. And then you want to focus on how you can steer your own career to where you're in charge of the machines and you're manipulating what the machines do. And it's not, you know, it's not easy and not everyone's going to make the cut, but you know, that's what I think about. And I think that's a smart thing for investors to try to focus on.
Yeah. It's a very Tyler Cowen-esque picture of the future. If you've read Average is Over, it's exactly what he describes. And it doesn't need to be scary if you're prepared for it and you're moving to the right side of the table.
Well, yeah, I mean, you certainly have to try.
Yeah. Well, Josh, I want to thank you for being a part of Fireside Markets this morning and wish you all the best.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
For additional information, details regarding references made in today's episode, or to subscribe or comment on this podcast, visit us online at basinasset.com.